Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. It's been a week of high water and hot pronouncements, starting with President Bush before the VFW linking Iraq with Vietnam.
One unmistakable legacy of Vietnam is that the price of America's withdrawal was paid by millions of innocent citizens.
Democratic Senator Carl Levin urged Iraq's prime minister to step down. Republican Senator John Warner urged the president to get some troops home.
I say to the president respectfully, pick whatever number you wish. You do not want to lose the momentum, but certainly in 160,000 plus, say 5,000, could begin to redeploy and be home to their families and loved ones no later than Christmas of this year.
And from Iowa and Wisconsin to Tennessee and Findlay, Ohio, high temps and deep water.
The floodwaters are very deep here. Nearly every street, every home, every business flooded here.
Joining us today from Washington is Matthew Continetti, associate editor for the Weekly Standard. He's author of The K Street Gang, The Rise and Fall of the Republican Machine. Matthew Continetti, welcome back. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Washington, Anna Mulrein, Pentagon correspondent and senior editor for U.S. News and World Report. Anna, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom, Anna, and Matt.
I want to dive right in on Iraq, and there's a lot here. There's the Vietnam reference, and all that suggests there's dates to get in, dates to get out. There's the, I guess, in general, a kind of pre-positioning here for the Petraeus Report and interpretations of pre-positioning. But let's listen to a string of tape, first of all, on the Iraqi leader, Nouri al-Maliki. Here's first President Bush speaking in Canada on Tuesday, acknowledging frustration with the Iraqi prime minister.
I think there's a certain level of frustration with the leadership in general, inability to work, to come together to get, for example, an oil revenue law passed or provincial elections.
All right. The president of the United States points to Baghdad and al-Maliki and says frustration. Michigan Democrat Carl Levin, John Warner was in on this too, but Carl Levin, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, called the Iraqi government non-functional and said that al-Maliki and his cabinet should be voted out of office.
I hope that the Iraqi Assembly, when it reconvenes in a few weeks, will vote the Maliki government out of office and will have the wisdom to replace it with a less sectarian, more unifying prime minister and government.
Okay, more incoming for al-Maliki. Then al-Maliki in Syria shot back that the Iraqi people elected him.
Everyone knows that the Iraqi government was elected by the Iraqi people, and nobody can impose timetables or deadlines on it. The only people who can do that are the Iraqis who elected the government.
More than that, he said, we, that is Iraq, Baghdad, can find friends elsewhere. And then we heard, and we'll get our feedback on this, President Bush at that VFW convention in Kansas City, then voicing his support for al-Maliki after having articulated that earlier frustration.
Prime Minister Maliki is a good guy, a good man, with a difficult job, and I support him. And it's not up to the politicians in Washington, D.C. to say whether he will remain in his position. That is up to the Iraqi people who now live in a democracy and not a dictatorship.
Okay, there is a lot of back and forth. Anna Mulrein, begin to wade in here with us. What is going on with all of that?
Well, I think when you look back, even to December, I think we remember there was the White House, the National Security Advisor, Stephen Hadley. He issued a memo that leaked and made a big splash in Baghdad, saying that Maliki's intentions seem good, but he's either ignorant of what's going on in his country, misrepresenting his intentions, or his capabilities aren't yet sufficient to turn his good intentions into action.
That's one thing. I mean, that was sort of, he's a dope, but here's in Levin, he should get out.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I think that's the question now, I think, that folks are grappling with. And you saw it in an interesting op-ed that several soldiers got together and wrote that was published in last Sunday's New York Times. I mean, to what extent you know, is should Maliki held, you know, be held accountable for some of the, you know, grave mistakes that, that the U.S. has made in the country early on? I mean, to what extent can he really, you know, consolidate this country that's so broken? And I think that's what folks are grappling with right now. I mean, I think it's clear that you know he hasn't built on some of the, you know, the time that the surge has given him, but you know, to what extent is he able to do that is another question.
Matthew Continetti, it's all woven together here, and we'll move on to views of the surge and the Vietnam reference. But what about, first of all, the back and forth on al-Maliki? Is this in touch or out of touch with reality in Iraq? Does Maliki share an agenda with Washington at this point?
Well, it would be silly to deny that there's been no political progress on the national level in Iraq. And I think this is a smart strategy for Democrats who have decided that they're not going to challenge the actual results of the surge so far in terms of military tactics and security results, but instead they're going to focus their criticism on the central government. I would add, though...
But you've also got President Bush and John Warner criticizing Maliki. It's not
Maliki
just Democrats.
Maliki is not the first elected Iraqi prime minister. We had al-Jafri beforehand, who also was subject to the same sort of criticism, which would suggest to me, anyway, that the problem here is institutional. My understanding, I mean, it's hard to understand the Iraqi political system because it's so complicated, but I believe that the prime minister, his importance and his role in the system is somewhat exaggerated by Americans because we are used to strong prime ministers. I think it's actually that position relatively weak in the Iraqi system.
Jack Beatty, the New York Times today in its editorial, an interesting kind of back and forth with Charles Krauthammer in the Washington Post. The Times saying what's emerging here is a fundamental disconnect and flaw in the American strategy. We've got the surge going on to make time for Iraqi political progress. National Intelligence Estimate out this week saying that's not happening, and the Times says it won't happen because al-Maliki represents a Shiite majority that's not interested in, you know, making nice with the Sunnis and everybody else.
That appears to be the case, and, you know, the surge has already cost us dearly. This has been the worst summer for American casualties since the war began. 243 killed in June, July, and August last year, 169. We learned that the surge in today's New York Times has coincided with a doubling of the amount of internal displacement, people displaced from their homes in Iraq, that the basic security that we'd hoped the surge would gain has been lost, and partly because of the combat in neighborhoods. So yes, there's been a deterioration in terms of the security of the Iraqi people, and this government an unwillingness to make changes. You know, in Washington, there's some talk of Awad Alawi, the U.S. installed first person that we put in there as a leader, a longtime CIA beneficiary, and he had an op-ed piece in the Washington Post. He's hired Haley Barbour's public relations firm. He's hired Philip Zelikow, the former deputy to Secretary Rice, to make his case that he should be reinstalled.
He's got a strong man reputation, Alawi.
Yes, he has. Yes, he has. And so you hear that, and I see in today's on Juan Cole's blog today, he has some talk from Baghdad about people. Or actually from Jordan, talking about a possible military coup from within the Iraqis' military.
Matthew Continetti, what about these different views of the New York Times editorial board and then Charles Krauthammer? Krauthammer listens to Democrats who are acknowledging this week, some leading Democrats, some progress on the military front, at the same time dissatisfaction with Maliki. And he, Krauthammer, sees convergence between partisan views of the war. On the other hand, the Times says, no, there's a fundamental contradiction here. This is going nowhere.
Well, I believe it or not, I side with the Times editorial page on this issue because I do think that the sides in the American political debate are so polarized that there's going to be little chance of compromise. I would add, though, that I've been quite surprised at the lack of coverage of Brian Baird. He's a Democratic representative from Washington. He voted against the Iraq War in 2002. He recently returned from a trip to Iraq, and his conclusion was that the progress there on the security front was worth giving this current strategy more time. That's also, in fact, one of the conclusions of the National Intelligence Estimate, which was leaked this week, which said that if we were to adopt what some even Republican senators are advocating, which is a kind of a fallback to the previous pre-Petraeus strategy of simply training the Iraqi forces while withdrawing, then the security gains we've made will have been lost. So I think Baird is just a legitimate voice on this, as, say, John Warner is.
It's not just Baird. I mean, even Hillary Clinton was this week kind of aligning her message in a new way, pointing to some successes in Iraq. Let's listen.
We've begun to change tactics in Iraq and in some areas, particularly in Al-Anbar province. It's working.
There's Hillary Clinton voicing along those same lines, others saying quite different things. Anna Mulrein, this is quite a mess of perspectives in advance of September 15th. But what about the concern that Shiites in power, in the majority, are not going to go for the kind of reconciliation with Sunnis that the surge seems premised on achieving? If that doesn't come, where do we go here?
Yeah, I think that's the big question right now. I mean, you look at something like the Anbar Awakening, as it's being called, that a lot of folks are pointing to as a promising sign.
Sunnis there pushing back against al-Qaeda, but that quite apart from Shiite Baghdad.
Exactly. Well, that's the question here. I mean, to what extent are those sorts of gains replicable across the country? I mean, I think the idea of, essentially being anti-Al-Qaeda is not the same as being pro-government. And so you have these what amount to Sunni militias that we're trying to aid in their fight against Al-Qaeda. But you know, that is not the dream come true of the Maliki government.
We're looking at a week in the news. Bush on Iraq and Vietnam, Washington on Maliki and withdrawal, big floods in the Midwest and more. President Bush at that VFW convention in Kansas City, here comparing earlier U.S. battles in Asia to the war in Iraq.
There are many differences between the wars we fought in the Far East and the war on terror we're fighting today. But one important similarity is at their core, there are ideological struggles.
And then the link to Vietnam.
One unmistakable legacy of Vietnam is that the price of America's withdrawal was paid by millions of innocent citizens whose agonies would add to our vocabulary new terms like boat people, re-education camps, and killing fields.
Okay, Jack Beatty, here we are talking about Iraq and talking about boat people, re-education camps, killing fields. What do you make of the president pushing Vietnam into the middle of this big debate?
Well, it's audacious. Personally, he had a chance when he was in the Texas Air National Guard to check the box that would volunteer him for service in Vietnam. He didn't check it. His vice president famously said he had other priorities during the Vietnam War. They were for the war, so long as they didn't have to fight it. But then to the substance, I think the Times rightly points out that the essential parallel is there was a corrupt, irresponsive South Vietnamese government that could not win the loyalty of its own people. We have something very similar today in Iraq. And, you know, all the military success in the world, the tactical success in the world, won't matter darn if there can't be political reconciliation or even effective governance. So I think this is an analogy, it seems to me, that works against him. And no one is saying that if we leave, things are going to be fine. Everyone concedes the civil war will go on and probably intensify, but it'll go on and intensify whether we leave now or in 5 years. The difference will be we may leave with, 4,000 dead rather than 7 or 10.
Matthew Continetti, how do you read the Vietnam analogy? Do you just take it at face value, the president warning against dead after a U.S. withdrawal from a war we're in now?
Well, I think that's a factual statement, what he said. In fact, Bush's comparison to me was remarkably constrained. He only made two comparisons to Vietnam. One, that once, more technically speaking, once the American government cut off aid to the South Vietnamese government in 1975, the North then invaded the South, and the consequences of that are pretty clear. And he spoke about them in terms of vocabulary, boat people, re-education camps, later killing fields. And then the second comparison he made to Vietnam was that there was a substantial loss in American credibility as the result of America's not only the withdrawal from Vietnam, cutting off of funding for the government. So I think those two are just factual statements. But what's funny to me about this debate is not that the Bush's critics have a problem with comparing Iraq to Vietnam. Indeed, they've been doing that since long before the Iraq War ever began. It's just that they have a problem with comparisons that undermine the case for withdrawal.
Killing fields, I mean, is that a factual statement? It was the U.S. engagement with Cambodia, many say, which started the slip toward that. Can the president pile all that on the U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam and U.S. credibility? Isn't that already in a, you know, pretty deep shaft? You know, never mind a withdrawal from Iraq.
And it would only get worse if America were to leave. And in terms of America's role in Cambodia, that's a subject of your point of view. That's not the question. To me, the broader question is simply the people of varying the debate has become less about your plans for the future in Iraq than it is about validating your views in the past conflicts in America. That's Bush was sure it was audacious of Bush to enter this debate, but I do still think it's a valid debate.
A bold thing to bring on the table in a war as unpopular as this one, citing a war as unpopular as that one. Let's go to our listeners. David in Northampton, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'm just calling in on the Vietnam issue, and I guess I may be echoing some of the sentiments of one of the speakers. But first of all, I think it's downright laughable. Audacious is a good word that Bush is now bringing up the Vietnam analogy after he tried so hard to distance himself from comparisons with Vietnam a couple of years ago. Now that it suits his purpose, any port in a storm to justify keeping this war going, he's now reverting again to an old Bush administration trick, which is the politics of fear. If we leave, this is going to happen. All these bad things are going to happen. He is trying desperately to do anything to keep this war going until he limps out of office. And I think it's insulting to me as a citizen that he should take a podium on a national stage as our president and make that analogy under these sorts of circumstances. I think it's an example of the laughability of spin and the ability of politicians to say anything they please and get away with it and not be accountable for it. I really feel as though our government is just trashing us. I feel like,
David, let me ask you, lots of kinds of accountability here, but are you so sure that the president is wrong on the simple point of if U.S. troops leave, there will be bloodshed?
Well, Tom, we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't. In terms of the U.S. troops being there now in the surge, it's like a dam or a dike with holes opening up left and right. Sure, we can plug a hole with troop influx into a region and gain security, but you know, we can't be everywhere at once in Iraq. That's the problem, and that goes back to the whole issue of unless there's some sort of coalescence of political stability. We'll be there indefinitely. So it's not a question of what will happen when we leave, because we're going to have to leave, or we're going to have to stay forever.
David, we've got it, and we see the National Intelligence Estimate with exactly that high concern about the Iraqi government being able to step into any progress the U.S. makes and make something of it. Anna Mulrine, how do you read the president putting Vietnam out on the table?
Well, I think what a lot of Democrats kind of took from that comparison, too, kind of in their comments was maybe this Vietnam comparison should invite us to think about how to minimize the consequences of our military failure. I mean, you look at an area like Basra, and like the caller was saying, I mean, how our forces there are spread so thin, that essentially U.S. security forces can't play a role in this area of Basra, which is a region where British forces have been in control and are now departing, and it's breaking down miserably. I mean, folks within the Pentagon are saying kind of privately that this is an example of sort of how not to leave an area. It's been a disaster.
So military progress in Anbar, but look around the map and you don't have quite that perkiness elsewhere.
That's it. I mean, you can look at an area like Basra where, even USAID efforts like the PRTs, these provincial reconstruction teams that are supposed to help build provincial governments are unable to operate. There are Shiite factions that are kind of duking it out for control of these regions. So there's no unity. It's not even a traditional Sunni Shia battle. It's a grappling for power within these Shiite factions.
I think it's a
harbinger of what may be to come.
Let's take a call from Panama City, Florida, and Kelly. Kelly, you're on the air.
Well, thank you, Tom. I think it was really interesting how the president talked about, words that were introduced into the vocabulary with our pullout from Vietnam. What about the vocabulary the Iraqis now have because of our invasion? Sectarian violence, ethnic cleansing, civil war, and Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which didn't exist before we invaded. We created the enemy that we are now making progress against in Al-Anbar province, and that is a completely different thing. That's mostly due to the tribal leaders rising up against Al-Qaeda in Iraq, something we created, completely different than trying to get the Shia government to make nice with the Sunnis. That's not going to happen, and we can, the nicer we make it, the less likely they are to do that. They have no incentive to share power.
Kelly, thanks very much for that. Matthew Continetti, how about it? We have seen some Sunni sheikhs rising up in Anbar against Al-Qaeda. That's been very heartening. That's the heart of the progress people are pointing at. But what if they have no Baghdad government to plug into? Is it just kind of a, you know, progress in isolation that almost doesn't matter to the national picture in Iraq?
Well, one additional factor, in addition to the tribal sheikhs in Anbar and elsewhere, some of the sheikhs in Diyala province and some of the sheikhs in Nasiriya province have also been joining these grassroots efforts against Al-Qaeda in Iraq. In addition, once these sheikhs flip, many of the Sunnis who live in these areas, they join the Iraqi security forces. So in a sense, this is one way in which the grassroots political developments help strengthen the central government in Iraq.
But is that just
joining Iraqi army?
But does it really, or is that just arming up for a civil war later if they're not really integrated with the Shiite power center in Baghdad?
Well, the army takes its orders from the central government in Baghdad, so of course it's integrating with that government. Look,
yeah, well, we've seen many examples where that is not the case. Yeah.
The National Intelligence Estimate says that there's vying for the Shiite government, that the government is riven by factional fighting. But at the end of the day, none of the factions want to dump Maliki because they're afraid that it would simply paralyze the government.
Well,
so the problems of Iraq are deep, but they're not going to get any better if America leaves.
Let's go to Jamil calling from Sharon, Massachusetts. Jamil, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm an American citizen, obviously, but with passion about Iraq because I was born and raised in Iraq.
Okay.
I think as an American citizen and I work in the VA, we really need to cut our losses right now. We have too many losses. I was very much for the invasion, for the change of the regime, but we mismanaged it. Americans mismanaged it, and now we have enemies, as my previous caller mentioned, because of our presence there. Not enemies inherent only.
Jamil, let me ask you, as an Iraqi-born American, if U.S. troops stay long enough, do you foresee reconciliation between Sunni and Shiite and a unity government, a real one?
No. If we had somebody, a secular government like Alawi or others, in charge with a power base, yes. But basically, a religious-based government, and Maliki's is a weak government, has been shown, we have to get out. It's a dysfunctional state. They have to take care of themselves. Yes, there will be bloodshed. I hope there won't be killing fields, but eventually it will have to rectify itself, just like in any other intervention. We've started the process. We cannot achieve total success there. We, at some point in the future, we may have to go back as advisors and in different fields. That's a different thing. Our military cannot afford any more losses because of internal strife, no matter what Anbar quasi-victory seems like.
Mm. And there's the view from an Iraqi-born American. Of course, all this heading straight out onto the political trail. Here's Republican sort of candidate-in-waiting Fred Thompson talking to the VFW conference, saying, stay the course.
Some people in this country apparently think if we can pull out of Iraq, our problems are going to be over. You and I know better than that.
There's Fred Thompson. On the other hand, you've got Barack Obama, Democratic candidate, praising the troops in Iraq, but saying he's sticking to his message that the strategy in Iraq is not working.
No military surge, no matter how brilliantly performed, can succeed without political reconciliation and a surge of diplomacy in Iraq and the region. Iraq's leaders are not reconciling.
Democrat Barack Obama on the war this week. Jack, how do you read all this playing out politically? The Vietnam piece, the stay or go piece, the prepositioning before Petraeus?
Well, I think the Vietnam piece is part of the stab in the back narrative for the future, that you know, it'll be the war's opponents in this telling who are responsible for our defeat. And I think that's going to be, you know, we're going to hear that theme for years after we leave Iraq. But you know, I just want to return for a moment, Tom, if I might, to this remarkable New York Times op-ed by that Anna mentioned, by the seven members of the 82nd Airborne Division.
The War as We Saw It, was headlined in the Times.
Yeah, now they say, you know, and it's kind of the anti-Potemkin tour reporters report. They say, you know, we're military superior, but our successes are offset by failures elsewhere. The battle space, they say, remains the same, and they point to things like the Iraqi army and police jointly setting bombs against the Americans, and then the locals come forward and say, you know, we knew they were setting those bombs, and why didn't the locals tell them? Because the Iraqi police or army would have killed them. They go on to talk about the bewildering variety of threats that Americans face from criminals, from gangs, from the militia, and then they say something I think really profound when they say that in the end we need to recognize that our presence may have released Iraqis from the grip of a tyrant, but it also robbed them of their self-respect. They will soon realize that the best way to regain dignity is to call us what we are, an army of occupation, and force our withdrawal. This from seven enlisted men, one of whom we learn was shot in the head after this. I think he's recovering, but he was shot in the head after this article was written.
Anna Mulrine, you cover the Pentagon. What do you make of these seven 82nd Airborne veterans speaking up in this way, of their personal views, as they say, but boy, it comes right in the middle of the whole debate.
It sure does. It sure does. And I mean, I think Jack nailed it with, I mean, when you spend time in Iraq, you hear that from the soldiers on the ground. I mean, they're working hard. I mean, it's a lot of these military guys who are really doing political work. I mean, every day they're in there trying to broker these deals and sitting down with provincial council members and really trying to hammer out some sorts of local agreements to get coalitions back into the, you know, back into this provincial government, building that's heavily guarded and you know, under constant threat of attack. And you hear their frustration about the infiltration within the security forces, within the army, particularly within the police, not being sure who they can trust. And when they do feel a great deal of trust in, for example, a particular division commander who they feel like, okay, this guy is a good guy who's working hard, it doesn't matter. It may or may not matter because, you know, at the ministry level, within the Ministry of Defense, within the Ministry of Interior, there are edicts, coming down hard, telling them exactly what they should be doing and basically counteracting and undermining, some of the good gains that they make. And I mean, I think when Jack points to this op-ed too, it echoes what you hear a lot on the ground in Iraq. And I think, you know, I was particularly struck in that op-ed too with these soldiers kind of recognizing and saying that Iraqis are feeling increasingly insecure and as Jack was saying, view us as an occupation force and frustrated that after 4 years, our presence has failed to kind of produce this normalcy, and as they write, is increasingly unlikely to do so as we continue to arm each warring side.
We're looking at a week in the news: Bush on Iraq and Vietnam, Washington on Maliki and withdrawal, big floods in the Midwest, and more. Anna Mulrine is with us from U.S. News and World Report. Matthew Continetti from the Weekly Standard. Jack Beatty's here. It was a week of happy endings and sad endings. Big storms, big scores. Utah mine owner Bob Murray said he will close the deadly Crandall Canyon coal mine.
The mountain is alive. It's a deadly mountain, and I'm not going near it.
The space shuttle with a former teacher on board and some high drama moments in space returns safely to Earth.
Houston, Endeavor, we'll stop.
Roger, we'll stop, Endeavor. Congratulations, welcome home. You've been given a new meaning to higher education.
Yes, a new meaning, and the Texas Rangers give the hapless Orioles a monumental drubbing. At the end, it was 30-3.
The 1-0 pitch. Swung on. A high drive, deep right field. Back goes Peyton. It is history! A three-run homer, Ramon Vasquez. The Rangers have scored 30 runs tonight.
BK is calling from Cranston, Rhode Island. BK, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm just trying to get an analogy of this whole thing. Like a cat handling a ball of thread. And just for like 2 hours. And what happens? That's exactly what has happened to this war. We have to get away from this and buy a new war. That is, leave Iraq to form themselves. There'll be bloodshed. Yes, like India, what happened when Britishers left overnight? We had lots of bloodshed, but what are we now? Everybody needs the next day food. So nobody is going to stop just because of, I mean, the Americans are being right now here.
Well, BK, so you look at the Iraq War, you recall India and Pakistan, I think it was 1 million dead, and we've had a big anniversary. Yeah, but can we really just walk away and say, all right, the British did it in India, we should do it here, and let them die?
Yeah. Instead, we already have 640,000 people dead. That's million. So are we going to be part of it, or let Iraq be part of it? I mean, we removed the bad guy, but we removed it in the wrong sense. We had an excuse to remove it. Bad guy, we removed it. That's okay. But now what we have to do is take care of the Americans. I live in America. I feel proud to be an American now. So I want every American to be taken care of before an Iraqi or somebody is getting the school aid or something like that.
BK, we've got the perspective, and of course this is going to be hot in all the politics coming up ahead. Big television ad campaigns have been rolled out over the summer, and very recently, here's a little bit from Freedom's Watch. It's a conservative group whose spokesman is the former White House spokesman Ari Fleischer, bankrolled in part by Sheldon Adelson, a big Las Vegas casino guy, kicked off a $15 million TV ad campaign this week to spread the message that the buildup of U.S. troops in Iraq is working. Here, a woman who's lost two family members pleads for support for the war.
I lost two family members to Al-Qaeda. My uncle, a fireman on 9/11, and my husband Travis in Iraq. My husband fought so my children did not have to 10 years from now. Congress did the right thing, voting to defeat terrorism in Iraq and Afghanistan. Switching their votes now for political reasons, it will mean more attacks in America. Call your congressman and senator. Tell them surrender is not an option. Victory is America's only choice.
Surrender is not an option. Matthew Cotteny, what do you think about the political strength of the tack that we heard Fred Thompson taking, that the president's helping clear a way for here on the war?
Well, among Republicans, this is a very popular position. The war continues to be popular. Now, Republican support has declined somewhat, but I believe it will actually increase in the coming months, certainly with Petraeus' report. But the country is divided on this. The war is extremely unpopular among Democrats. Independents also are against the war, though they're more closely divided than, say, the Democrats are, which support for the war is in single digits. So we have a divided country. And Freedom's Watch, that organization that you just played the ad for, they'll be running their ads. And MoveOn.org will be running their ads. And you have what has become basically a political campaign in the middle of what is supposed to be, I think, a debate about the conduct of American policy in Iraq. But I would add also, I think it was an extraordinarily bad decision on the part of this group, Freedom's Watch, to have Ari Fleischer as the group's spokesman. Even people on both sides of the debate tell me these ads are extremely powerful, and they come from people who have lost relatives in Iraq and Afghanistan. They come from veterans in Iraq and Afghanistan. Why the group did not choose a veteran, and there are plenty of pro-war veterans out there, including people like Vets for Freedom. Why they didn't choose a veteran to be the spokesman?
Who would have made that decision, Matthew? Who is the money behind this? A big casino owner, we read, is one of the people. Sheldon, is it Adelson?
A variety of men are in running the group. Ari Fleischer, I think, has also an organizational role, but I just think it would have made more sense. People aren't going to trust Ari Fleischer. Republicans will trust him, but people who have already made up their mind about the Bush administration will not. Whereas if they had a vet returning from Iraq who continues to support the intervention there, I think that would add more credibility.
We're going to turn to the flood and all the rest, but Jack, let me just get the MoveOn.org commercial in here too, the ads, and get your response to both, you and Animal Ryan, if I may. Here from earlier this month, MoveOn.org started running ads in four parts of the country. This one targets constituents of Kentucky Republican Senator Mitch McConnell.
Mitch McConnell has supported Bush's endless war in Iraq for 4 years. Now Bush's general says we have to stay there for 10 more.
The average counterinsurgency is somewhere around a 9 or a 10-year endeavor.
Where are we going to get the troops to stay that long? The draft.
I think it makes sense to certainly consider it. This has always been an option on the table.
Tell Mitch McConnell to end this war. Paid for by the Campaign to Defend America.
Jack, who do you think's making the critical hay in those two ads?
Well, you know, Mitch McConnell, not only does he have Move On spending money against him, but the Ari Fleischer Group is spending money against him. That's what's striking about these ads, practically all of them, so far as I can see, with the exception of Mark Pryor, a Democrat in Arkansas, practically all of them are Republicans. So here you have Republican members who have expressed equivocation on the war or the surge, and they're getting Republican money spent against them, and some of them are in tough races.
Sort of smacked into line.
Yes. Now, how is that going to affect them, you suppose? Do you suppose they're going to be pleased with Republican Central on this? And by the way, that quotation didn't come through in the tape. But that was, I think his name is General Lute. Is that his name? The man who's in charge of the czar for Iraq. Well, you know, he made that comment about the draft. That was on NPR. He said, well, yeah, we may have to think about a draft. Americans need to take that on board. That's the guy who's the czar of the Iraq war policy saying, well, you know, we can't dismiss that. Quite a statement.
If we go on, Anna, how are you reading the body language in this welter on Capitol Hill and Congress there? Are they going to stay lined up with the president as we head into a presidential campaign season? We saw John Warner make a little break here.
Absolutely. I mean, he's saying basically, well, just give us something. You know, give us 5,000 troops. You pick the number. I think a lot of the jockeying that you're seeing going on right now in advance of the Petraeus report that's set to be delivered to Congress, this report card on September 11th. I think there's so much jockeying going on because essentially folks know what it's going to say. I mean, this you know, the one thing I think Washington can agree on right now with regards to Iraq is this report will contain no revelation. I mean, Petraeus is going to essentially, you know, point to some areas of progress, point to some causes for concern and ask for more time for now. But what everyone also, what the military is keenly aware of is that, you know, the surge it's not possible for the surge to last past this summer, you know, really past late spring. That's when essentially if you want to keep the surge going, you have to extend troops who have already been extended to 15 months to a brutal 18-month tour. And General George Casey, he used to have Petraeus' job. He is now the Army Chief of Staff. And he basically said in a speech at the National Press Club earlier this month that he I think his words were very uncomfortable with that notion. He will not recommend it. He can't. You know, the strain on the soldiers is too great to
just
think about
much.
Them going to an 18-month tour.
And Senator Warner saying we've got to do something to relieve that and get the attention of the Baghdad government here.
We simply cannot, as a nation, stand and put our troops at continuous risk of loss of life and limb without beginning to take some decisive action which will get everybody's attention.
War and war all over, but not the only thing going on this week. Let's take a call from Davenport, Iowa, and Nicole. Hi, Nicole. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Pretty good. What do you see, Nicole?
What do I see? Well, right now I'm not seeing anything, but I'm a journalist, and I have been covering for the past week nothing but the floods of the Midwest.
Yeah,
and
huge.
I'm sorry?
Huge ones.
Huge ones. Oh, yeah, substantially. And not just floods. There's damage from high winds, too. And even in the areas where they're not getting all the torrential rains, there's still quite a bit of damage. There's a town in Knox County called Kirkwood, Illinois, and the entire town, yesterday afternoon, they sustained winds between 70 and 100 miles per hour, and not a tornado. But these winds were so strong that they knocked over buildings, specifically silos, where you can see these huge structures that have been essentially crushed like tin cans.
Wow. And Nicole, we've seen the pictures of farmers in canoes alongside their cornfields. What about the crops as a result of all this rain and flooding?
Well, then the rain has gotten it on both ends. I mean, there are... I don't think there has been a confirmed report of amount of damage, but there are, first, the crops were suffering because it's been so hot and dry, and then now the fields are flooding so much that, you know, we're not sure, the crops could start rotting, the roots could start rotting, and you might not have a crop. On top of that, thousands of acres or hundreds of acres have been blown over. So
just by the wind alone. Nicole, thanks for that firsthand report. I mean, you had that, Tropical Storm Aaron coming up the Mississippi Basin and then storm system over Minnesota meeting it there and quite the flooding and heat at the same time, not wet everywhere. Let's go to Fairview, Tennessee, and Stuart. Stuart, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Hello, folks. How are you?
Pretty good. What do you see out there, Stuart?
We're in an extreme drought here in Middle Tennessee, really all over the state. To give you a few examples, or to set the stage, go back to April 8th. We had a freeze April 8th, dropped down to 15 degrees. Preceding that, the driest and warmest March on record. Lost all the mass crop. There will be no acorns or hickory nuts or anything for wildlife this year. We proceed into the hottest August on record. We've had 14 days of 100 degrees or more in August so far. There's rationing of water within the municipalities in the state. They're even telling farmers you cannot use municipal water to water your livestock. The creeks and ponds are all drying up. We're in an extremely dire situation. There will be there's no hay. In fact, a round bale of hay 4 years ago was going for $15 to $20 a bale.
Yep.
Today, it's $75. I want to end with this little note. I think it's folly for our government to push ethanol, corn-based, as an alternative fuel source when Mother Nature is doing what you're seeing all over the country.
Mm.
We can't get a drop of rain, and just to the north and west of us, there are massive floods like this previous caller was talking about.
Yeah, boy, that gets our attention. You can't send an army out to shake rain out of the sky. Stuart, thanks very much for that. There's so much on the agenda here. Jack, you were looking at a speech that John Edwards gave this week, speaking out against the Washington establishment just yesterday up in your neck of the woods, Hanover, New Hampshire. Let's listen to just a bit of that and hear what you all think. Here's John Edwards.
It's rigged by greedy corporate powers that protect corporate profits. It's rigged by the very wealthy who are every day trying to ensure that they get even wealthier. At the end of the day, it's rigged by all those who benefit from the established way of doing things, the established order of things. For them, more of the same means more money, more power. They'll do anything they can to keep things exactly the way they are, not for the country, but for themselves.
Okay, John Edwards, not exactly leading in the polls and then coming on with a very tough message, even against fellow Democrats. It's all rigged. This is tough language, Jack.
It is, and he goes right to it. He says all the big ideas in the world won't make a difference if they have to go through this broken system that remains controlled by big business and their lobbyists. And then he takes a shot at Hillary Clinton. We cannot replace a group of corporate Republicans with a group of corporate Democrats. The American people deserve to know that their presidency is not for sale, the Lincoln bedroom not for rent, and lobbyist money can no longer influence policy in the House or Senate. A populist, strong populist speech from the man who in 2004 gave the best speech of that year, the Two Americas speech. We don't know whether it'll do him any good. Last week, as I mentioned on the show, he was embarrassed, to say the least, to be fined. He was part of a hedge fund that had been foreclosing on Katrina victims. But he's recouped this week with a very powerful statement about what we all know to be true, that government is run for the few.
Money on that side, immigration on the GOP side, hot this week, Matthew Continetti. Romney really going after Rudy Giuliani.
It is. I think when we look back on the 2008 race for the GOP nomination, we'll find that it was in this past week that the race was engaged. You know, I had written earlier that not many Republicans have woken up to the fact that Rudolph Giuliani does have a strong chance at winning the Republican nomination next year. Finally, Mitt Romney woke up to it and began attacking Giuliani for his immigration policies as mayor of New York City. And also Fred Thompson woke up to this fact as well, attacking Giuliani for his gun control policy. So we'll see how well Giuliani responds in the coming weeks.
And Animal, Ryan, I know you've been watching New Orleans as we come up on yet another anniversary of Hurricane Katrina that will be back in the headlines. What about progress or the lack thereof on that front?
Yeah, I think the lack thereof is you put your nail on the head. I mean, I think it's folks are feeling really demoralized down there. I mean, you've still got more than 160,000 residents who are still out of the city, still unable to return. And, you know, I mean, I think they just what they're calling it is essentially government and political nonchalance down there. You know, there's this huge fund of road home grant money that, you know, that essentially has not been distributed. And these federal funds you know, I mean, this fund may be going broke. I mean, it's basically short about $4 million. People aren't getting the money. You know, Blanco, the governor, has essentially thrown in the towel and said she isn't running for re-election. And, you know, and Mayor Nagin is also, I think, distracted, thinking about another run, a new campaign for a new political office. Mm.
An old storm still with us as the Midwest looks at storms and flooding right now this week. Fascinating conversation. Great to have you all with us. Anna Mulrine at U.S. News & World Report. Thank you very much for joining us today, Anna.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Matthew Continetti at the Weekly Standard, author of the K Street Gang. It's always good to have you with us. Thanks a lot for being here, Matthew.
Thank you, Tom.
Jack, have a great weekend. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.